Unfortunately, he has to leave us today already. So if you have questions, I guess you'd better ask them now. And he's talking about the scaling behavior of the general entropy of anyways.
Thank you very much for inviting me here. And that's the second time I give a talk here. The last time was in February. It's very nice. It's very nice in the springtime. This is a joint work with Israel Klick, who is a postdoc at Caltech. So the history of this work is this. I was studying something when I was a graduate student in Sweden some 8 years ago. And that's the Widom conjecture. And it is still not proven. And it was, for me, it had kind of a theoretical interest. And I will describe its connection with the classical Sturm-Segel limit theory, which was applied in Onziger's computation of the spontaneous magnetization of the 2D easing model. This work was put on the ice, as they say in Swedish, and I didn't go back to it. And then Israel had this model in which this result is applicable. And he just by chance met my advisor, Ari Lapton, from Sweden in Vienna at the Schrödinger Institute. And then we started to work on this when I was visiting Caltech a year ago. So that's now there is a new interest in this Widom's conjecture. So the plan is as follows. I will give a definition of entanglement entropy just for a finite dimensional case. And then I will list some results which were known for a one-dimensional case, different spin chain systems, and then two results for dimensions higher than one. And after that, we'll formulate our result for higher dimensions. And then I will describe the connection with Widom's formula. And it's really a version of a high dimensional version of the Sturm-Segel limit theorem. And then I will say two words about the history here. That's Onziger's work. So suppose that we have two Hilbert spaces and assume that they're just finite dimensional for simplicity. Then if we have a state which is in the tensor product space, then entanglement entropy measures how far this arbitrary state is from a product state. And it is well known that we can write down any C in the product space as a combination like this. And this is called the Schmidt decomposition. And because the norm of C is 1, all these numbers can be chosen to be real, and between 0 and 1 in this holds. And the phi and phbi are orthonormal vectors in the two spaces. So the entanglement entropy is defined either as a Shannon entropy of the squared Schmidt coefficients, or it will be the same as the for Neumann entropy for the reduced density matrix here. And I could also take rho b, it will give the same result, where reduced density matrix is defined as follows. So rho is simply the projection into the space C. So for us, C will be a ground state of some physical system. Now, the known results are the following. So what people have studied were entropy of a block in a spin chain of a size L, and as the size of the block tends to infinity. So it's like entropy between this block and then the rest of the system. So these are the works, and for us in particular, mathematically, the Jin and Karepin proved using a certain version of the Segel theorem that this entropy scales as a logarithm of L, so in dimension one. And they also computed the scaling coefficient. And Vidal and co-authors found this coefficient using some methods of conformal field theory.
But surely does not depend on the model that you take. I mean, there are some states with bigger entropy and others with smaller entropy.
Right. I will, in the next slide, I will show you the Hamiltonian so that you will see what model we're looking at.
I see. So, but all of this that you said, it goes like log L, doesn't mean a thing unless you say what the Hamiltonian is.
Yeah, sure. So here is the Hamiltonian. Now, in this work, the authors compute also, they don't evaluate the asymptotic behavior, but they find some explicit representation for the XX model. And then in the regime when XX becomes XY, they recover the result for the XY chain found by Jin and Bray. So anyway, here is the Hamiltonian. And with Pauli matrices, and then we could find some choosing different values. We, you know, this becomes a different model. But we're looking at the critical regime where lambda is small. And if lambda is big, then this will actually grow as L, not as log L. So for us, the critical. We study this entanglement entropy for critical systems. In that setting, it means that the magnetic field is small. So that's the result that Jin and Karepin found for the XX chain. And they used a certain asymptotic formula for determinants of topless matrices, which was proved by Baeser in the late 70s. And this is one version of the Fisher-Hartwig theorem, which is a generalization of cyclic field. Now, if one thinks about the higher dimensional case, then there is a known so-called area law for entropy, which means that if we have a higher dimensional case, if we have some region of size L, and we would like to compute the entropy of the modes inside that region with respect to the rest of the system, then entropy grows as the area of the region. So this is this was studied by early on by Bombelli and co-authors, and they studied entropy of a scalar field restricted to a subsystem and in connection with the black hole entropy. So this is not kind of entanglement entropy I'm looking at, but it has. This is what is known as an area law. And also, Sredniczky physically proved area law for a scalar field. And one could think about acoustic modes in a lattice model in higher dimension. So that was a physical argument. But then Plenio and co-authors very recently, proved it for the case of a harmonic lattice, which corresponds to this acoustic modes. So what they looked at was the following Hamiltonian. And here we have a lattice of some large size m. And then we choose a piece of size little m. And these are momenta, and matrix V is chosen so that we have a nearest neighbor interaction in this model. And they proved that the entropy of this subsystem has a lower and an upper bound with some coefficient, and then the size to the power d minus 1, which is the area of this cube here. Now, also very recently, Kitaev model was considered by Kamma and co-authors. And they also established the area law for this model. And it concerns a lattice on a torus in d dimensions. And in the Kitaev model, there are two types of interactions. One is a star, and the other is a plaquette. So we have a lattice on a torus, and then for each 5 or four vertices, we consider these combinations, and these are Pauli matrices. And the Hamiltonian is given by this sum over all stars and sum over all plaquettes. So they also they prove the area law for this model. Now, our work concerns the simplest situation when the area law does not hold. And so there is a note in the PRL, and also I have an old preprint, and which is now being reviewed. And also we're working on kind of mathematical justification of part of the results which we claim here. So we claim a number of results, and for some of them we have mathematical proofs, and these proofs are being written down now. So the case we're looking at is the non-interacting fermions in d dimensions, either on a lattice or in a continuum. So the Hamiltonian is given by, so we have the epsilon k here, which is the dispersion relation, and then these are the creation annihilation operators. And we're looking at temperature zero. So the criticality in that model means that the temperature is zero. If temperature is positive, then this entanglement entropy will be extensive, it will grow as a volume. But in the case of zero temperature, it will grow, as we will show, as a area times an extra logarithm of L. So it's faster than the area, but slower than the volume. Now, the ground state is given by some choosing some Fermi energy like this. Or you could think that this is a growing function, and then you could think that you pick out a compact set in the momentum space. This is what we will go into doing. So this is how we fix the ground state. And then we also fix, and this set will be called gamma, it's on the next slide. It's a compact set in the momentum space. And then we also fix a compact region, omega, in real space, and study entropy between the modes in that region and the rest of the system as the size of the region L grows. So L is the kind of this, you know, scaling factor. Now, so more precisely, in the continuous case, we have two compact sets in RD. It should really be capital D. And in the lattice case, the real space is a lattice, so we pick a kind of a compact finite set in a lattice, and then momentum space in the torus, so we pick a set in a torus. And then we consider two operators like this. Q is a multiplication by the characteristic function of the scaled set omega. And P is restricting the Fourier transform to the set gamma in the momentum space. So here F could be either Fourier transform or Fourier series. And I have inverse here because my real space is a lattice. Usually you think the Fourier series is the momentum space, but here it's really the real space. Now, in such a setting, it was found by Klick that it's not obvious, this result. So you should introduce some Fock spaces here and compute the entangle. But surprisingly, what it boils down to is such a formula for the entanglement entropy. So this function H is a standard function in the theory. A function like this, and then we have the operator PQP, which is a compact operator, so its eigenvalues tend to zero. And we compute, and it's also a trace class, which can be also shown because it's a product of PQ and QP, which are both trace class because the and which are both Hilbert-Schmidt because the sets are compact. So the trace of this operator here gives us the entanglement entropy. This is what he found. And it turns out that other important quantities of interest, such as the average number of fermions, will be given simply by this. And the variance, the number variance, is given by such a trace. And now I just want to announce that these operators PQP, if you think about them, these are very natural things to look at if you want to study. These are very natural operators, and I will say more about it. But basically what happens is that you want to know about maybe a signal. If you restrict, you measure a restriction of a signal to some set, it's maybe to some time interval and also to some frequency interval. And this will be the sets Q and P. Or alternatively, you would like to say something about the function. If you know it, there is restriction to some set, say omega, and then the restriction of its Fourier transform to some set gamma. So the way to study such a process is to look at the operator PQP, and then maybe if you would know its eigenvalues, you would be able to say something about the function if you apply this operator to a function. So this operator PQP is a standard operator in signal theory, and it was studied a long time ago. And it's interesting that it appears in this setting here.
So this is essentially the Fermionian entropy of PQP and
R-PQP. Right. And then these operators act in a one-particle space. So, all right. So, anyway, what we found is the following. So, first of all, let us consider the case of cubes. In that case, in both continuous and discrete case, gamma will be such an interval to the power d in a torus, or maybe in the real in Rd, and then omega will be either a product of intervals from 0 to some Lj, or maybe a product of lattice points like that. And then what we found for this cubic case is a two-sided inequality for the entropy in terms of one-dimensional entropy. So S1 is simply the following. You have a one-dimensional case, and then on the Fourier transform side, or the Fourier series side, you have an interval, and then you have an interval from 0 to Lj on a lattice, or maybe on the real line. So this object S1 would, in particular, for example, for the XX chain, it was we know the asymptotic expression for this S1, in particular for the XX chain. Now, from this formula, it becomes apparent that if you, for example, take all these things to be the same, then you have this two-sided estimate and even some numeric coefficients here for the entanglement entropy. And we could now refer to this result by Jin and Krepin to see that really entanglement entropy in that case satisfies this condition, and there is also a lower bound. So it really violates this the area law. Now, so how can we generalize this? I mean, this case can be treated quite easily because all the variables separate out. If we had cubes which were kind of disoriented, then this wouldn't go through. It's just that everything becomes one-dimensional, essentially. So we have some results for the general case as well, but in particular, using sub-additivity of entropy, we could prove that if omega were a union of cubes, then we would have an upper estimate which has not a larger order. Now, for the case of sets with general boundaries, there is a way of estimating entropy in terms of the number variance. And the idea, I believe, belongs to Fan, Hageman, and Massoni. So what they looked at the lattice case in dimension 1. And then if you think about this, the function h, which is x log x plus 1 minus x log 1 minus x, then this is the middle function here. I mean, it's not a very good picture, but that's the function which is in here. And it has vertical tangent lines at the end. So you can estimate it below by the function 4x times 1 minus x. And because of that, you can estimate, taking the traces, then all the eigenvalues of the operator PQP are in the interval from 0 to 1. So taking the traces, we prove this lower estimate. So this is what they came up with. And also, for the lattice case in dimension 1, they could prove that they were looking at the function, basically x 1 minus x again, but with some larger coefficient. So they were estimating this function with infinite derivatives by a shifted function of that form. So it's both multiplied by something, and then they added a constant to it. So they were kind of doing this. But in the lattice case, it works because we just have a finite number of points, because basically the trace of the operator Q is finite. However, if you think about the continuous case, this is not going to work, because if you add a constant, such an operator has an infinite trace. So what we prove this estimate, and in the lattice case, the proof is analogous to what they had. It's really no modification. But for the continuous case, we introduced a function which had a square root. And this function, the derivative goes away, and it goes kind of to infinity faster here. So this function will really estimate our function from above. And then we add the same type of function to it, and then by choosing epsilon to be of order 1 of the log L, we can prove this the same factor here. And what we use is the operator monotonicity of the function square root. And this is some classical result which goes back to Loebner, the percolation. Okay, so that's something, from 38 or something like that. So this is an estimate, but we believe that it's not an optimal estimate. This logarithm shouldn't really be in here. It's just because of our method that we get this logarithm. Now, so this estimate with the extra logarithm, it was proven independently 3 weeks before our paper was posted by Michael Wolff, who's been working in this theory for quite some time. And what he proved is that he proved this estimate for cubes in the lattice case. But remember, for the case of the cubes, we really have an estimate without the extra logarithm. We have estimates, we have expressions for the coefficients as well. So for that case, we have a stronger result. Now, so the next step would be to estimate this particle fluctuation quantity, right? And for this, we have the following formula. for the lattice case. I'm sorry, for the continuous case. So if omega and gamma are two compact sets with smooth boundaries, then delta n squared, which is the trace of the basically PQP times 1 minus PQP, it has this asymptotic behavior as L tends to infinity. So this is a lower order term, and this is the leading term. And if we assume this, then for the continuous case from our formula star, we find this estimate, which still has the wrong power of the logarithm. But this holds for bodies of a general shape here. Now, the way we found this expression is because it is a particular case of that Widom's conjecture that I will speak about now. I just would like to say that this is a very nice geometrical coefficient here. So nx and x and nc are unit normals to the boundaries of the set, of the two compact sets. And so, for example, if one of the sets were a sphere, this would be just the average cross section of one of the sets times the area of the other set. And if they have general shapes, and this is some quantity, and it's easy to understand that, for example, if we have two long sets, then if they are oriented in the same direction, then this integral is going to be large. However, if they orient it like this, this integral will be smaller. So this kind of is a nice geometric coefficient. So now what does Widom's conjecture state? So this was this is the following hypothesis. So suppose that we have operators PQP as before. So one is a multiplication by a characteristic set over with over characteristic function of a set with smooth boundary in RD, and Q is the operator of kind of restricting the Fourier transform of a given function to a set with a smooth boundary. And these operators P and Q, they act in L2 of RD in the continuous case. And then we have a function F, which is analytic on a disk of radius bigger than 1. And the reason for that is because the norm, this operator is 1, so we want this kind of series for F to converge, so that's why we assume that the function is analytic there. And also we assume that there is no constant term in the series because then the trace would be infinity. Now, what the claim is the following, that as L, so L is we expanding one of the sets by a factor L. So the claim is that the trace of this function of the operator behaves in this way. Now, if you, so this is a wild type term, which you find when you count the number of eigenvalues of the Laplace operator on a compact manifold, for example. So this set here is just basically the product of the volume of the phase space, if you want. And then there is the value of f of 1. And this is the natural logarithm. So that's the expression that Widom conjectures for the subleading term. And you see that it has precisely this integral over the boundaries. And then the coefficient here is has this form. So it's just a number which depends on a given function. So we just compute this integral, and that's the coefficient. So if we take the function f to be t times 1 minus t, then we recover the expression of the previous slide. this is how we guessed it, right? So this result now is a verification of Whedon's conjecture for this particular function. So what is the status of this conjecture? By the way, this is Harold Whedon, who now works in random matrix theory, and this is Whedon, the Tracy Whedon distribution for the largest eigenvalue of a random matrix, and he's been working in segue-type limit theorems for maybe 25 or 30 years before he switched to random matrix theory in early 90s. And this conjecture is basically, if you want, the crown jewel of his work, because that's the thing that was never really proven up to date. So in the one-dimensional case, Whedon, together with Landau, proved it for dimension one. Now, 2 years later, Whedon proved it for the case where you allow, again in one dimension, when in the case where you allow not just discontinuous function of x and discontinuous function of xi here, but you allow also a factor inside which smoothly depends upon x and xi. And then the formula is similar to that. So the difficulty here is, I'm not sure if that's too mathematical, but the difficulty here is that the this operator, if you write its kernel, it's an integral operator. So if you write down its kernel, then the symbol of the kernel will have discontinuity in both position and momentum. If it had just discontinuity in one of the position and momentum, then this would be an easier problem, and the asymptotic, there will be no logarithm then. So this, the next term would be just d minus 1, and we didn't study that earlier. So that's the difficulty. And then in 1990, he considered the case of higher dimensions, but this result only applies for the case when one of the set is a half space and the other is compact and smooth boundary. And then there is some decay in the case of a sum of a half space. It's like a smooth decay, so that traces exist. Now, note that even the set of a even the situation when we have like a half space maybe with not a flat boundary, this situation is not covered by the proof. So there are some difficulties there which are not overcome. So that's the status. Now, what I could do was really just a one-term formula. I could prove the leading term and then also a sharp remainder S, which had the expected order. And I also considered sets with self-similar boundaries, which would have a different behavior here. So if you have bad sets, then the error term here could be L to the power as close to D as you want. It would be D to minus epsilon here by choosing those fractal sets to be bad enough. So it's not this behavior. And also, this is useful because this shows that this entanglement entropy, if you want, people are interested in bad situations as well, and it shows that it can grow actually not as with the logarithmic correction, but it could be worse than that if you have bad sets. All right. Now, yes?
So we were different from the result that Fonis and people had, where you could have different behavior even in
one dimensional
class.
What they prove is that if you have a kind of a fractal situation, then it's the same order above and below. It's the power is the same, but in the estimate from above they have an extra logarithm. So I'm just saying that it can be bounded below by something which grows. But in the estimate above, you will have this logarithm because that's the artifact of the method. So, So now, note that in our case, this function h is not analytic. So even if we knew this conjecture, then strictly speaking, we can't apply it. Because for our function h, which has, for example, x log x, that even the first derivative is infinite at zero. So that's, it's not clear, I mean, how much this is related at all to the question of entanglement entropy. It's related, certainly, to the estimate involving the particle rotation number, because it has this t1 minus t, which is nice and analytic. But the case of this function h is not clear. However, if you look at the formula and just do what people in physics do, just substitute this function h here and here, then computing these things, also know that h is 1 at 1 is 0. So there will be no leading term, because the leading term here has this h at 1. So what this Williams conjecture suggests is the following expression for the entanglement entropy. Now, well, here I should really put plus lower order term. And has this nice coefficient 1/12. So let's note that this is consistent with the case of the one-dimensional case, because this all disappears, and then you have two intervals. So this is just a set of which contains 4 points, and this is always 1. So you recover this coefficient of 1/3 that Karev and Jin computed for the one-dimensional case. Well, again, they looked at the lattice case, and this we're looking at the continuous case. But we're sure that at least for the one-dimensional continuous case, the same formula will hold, and this can be proven. I mean, it's not finished, but this can be proven by some Riemann-Hilbert method, because the operator PQP in that case is related to the operator with the sine kernel restricted to an interval, simply because the Fourier transform of the characteristic function, you know, interval from minus a half to a half will be the sine kernel, sine of the difference divided by the difference. So anyway, now the second comment is that this formula that we conjecture was checked numerically, again not for the continuous case but for the lattice case. So people just looked at this formula for cubic domains in the lattice case for dimension 2 and 3. So there are two groups, one from Germany and one from University of Southern California. And they did this numerical computations, and very recently, let me show you what they found. So this is for dimension 2. So so basically, this line will be what we predict, and the crosses or the pluses is what they computed using the computer, and they write exact here. And the size of the lattice is 70 by 70, but exact means that simply that they can do this precise numerical computation. So of course, they can't solve it exactly. So that's one picture. And the other one is from the second preprint, where also the three-dimensional case was looked at. And here again, the solid line is our prediction, and the triangles are the numerical values. And here you can see that's kind of the formula that from our preprint. So anyway, this indicates really that the same expression should hold in the lattice case as well. But we're not quite ready to conjecture for the lattice case. Okay, so I guess I have like 5 minutes or something, or maybe seven minutes. So let me remind you the what the Segal limit theorem is, because that's kind of a classical result, and it was used in physics. So the strong Segal limit theorem is the following statement. So suppose that you have unit circle, and then you have a function which is positive and smooth and, you know, non-zero, bounded away from zero. Then you consider the operator of multiplication by this function acting in L2 on the circle. That is one operator. Then in that space, L2 on the circle, you have the natural basis, the, you know, exponential functions. And the second operator that you consider would be the restriction. It also acts in L2 on the unit circle, and it restricts the Fourier series of a given function to just a finite piece with coefficients from minus n to n. That's the second operator. Now, the statement of this theorem from 1952 is that if you look at this, let me tell you that the matrix B, if you write it in the standard, if you write the matrix B in the basis given by those exponents, it would be an infinite matrix, and it will be Toeplitz matrix. So on the main diagonal, you will have the zeroth Fourier coefficient of the function B, and here you will have minus first, and here you will have first. So a Toeplitz matrix is a matrix, and it also continues the other side. So a Toeplitz matrix is a matrix so that you have the same number along each kind of diagonal. So the matrix elements depend only on the difference of the indices. This is what a Toeplitz matrix is. And that's the matrix representation of this operator of multiplication by the function B. So this object here is really what happens is that you just take this matrix and cut a piece of size 2n plus 1 by 2n plus 1. That's a finite size matrix. And then you study its determinant, or the logarithm of its determinant. And it turns out that as the size tends to infinity, this will be the leading coefficient. So this is logarithm of that function, and it's okay because the function is bounded away from zero. So this is like the zeroth Fourier coefficient of the function log b. And then there also will be a constant here, which does not depend on n, which is given by this expression here. So you take the function log b, and you compute its Fourier coefficients. Alternatively, you could just write down the absolute value of the k coefficient squared. And maybe I'm missing a factor of 1/2 or 1/4 or something like that. Plus a little of 1. Now, why is this at all related to the Williams formula is because logarithm of a determinant of a matrix is the same as the trace of the logarithm of a matrix. That's a well-known fact. So the left-hand side here is really trace of the logarithm. So this logarithm is like the function f. And what we have, the leading term on the right, this thing here, is nothing but trace of the pn log bpn. So this is the operator of multiplication by b. And then if you think what its trace is, it would be the sum of the diagonal elements of this matrix. But these diagonal elements are just the zeroth Fourier coefficients of the matrix log b, of the function log b. And we have 2n plus 1 of them, so the leading term here is just this. So basically what happens is you could move this f aside. So this is like pn f of b pn. This is the leading term. I mean, of course, pn and b do not commute. Otherwise, this will be equal to that. And this is a correction. Now, what Williams conjecture is concerned with is, again, we have an operator like PQP. So Q is now not operated with multiplication by a smooth function, but by the characteristic function. And then the leading term is really given by trace P f of q p, if you think about it. So the leading term here is nothing but trace of p f of q p. If you compute it, it will be this, plus this correction. So Widow's conjecture is just basically a version of Segre limit theorem for the high-dimensional continuous case. So now, what is physical connection here is the following. So if just remind you this famous result, what was studied is the easing two-dimensional lattice, and then the partition function for this model is given by the following. So the spins are either plus or minus ones, and then there are interactions k1 and k2 which differ from in a horizontal and vertical direction. And these sigmas, okay, sigmas are plus minus ones, and then the product is over the nearest neighbors, so it's like a star interaction. So this is the easing model, and then we compute the average of the product of the two spins over this partition function, and one is the corner and the other is the mth spin in a line. And then the limit of this is the squared magnetization, and what was proven by in Onziger, kind of, I don't think he ever published the derivation, but there is a paper by Montreux and there are other papers as well. I'm forgetting now, but this is late 50s, early 50s and the 60s, basically. So Montreux, Potts, and third author gave full detailed derivation. Now, the interesting thing is that this quantity can be written as a Toeplitz determinant for some function b, okay? And this was observed by Onziger. However, so the asymptotic as m tends to infinity is what we would like to compute with magnetization. Now, it turns out that for this function, the leading term in Segre formula, which involves the average of the logarithm of that function. Turns out that for that particular function that arises here, this average is zero. So the leading term vanishes at the point. And to compute this, you really need this subleading term. So this is the reason why Segre found this second term. 1952, because the first order term he really found, you know, during the World War I. The paper appeared in 1915. And the subleading term, he found it almost 40 years later because it was basically needed for that proof. So Kakutani, as the history says, asked him about that. And Kakutani heard about this problem from Onziger. So this you can find in this Montreux paper from Journal of Mathematical Physics, 1963. So, anyway, the word strong Segre limit theorem referred to the fact that it's a two-term. Just the Segre limit theorem means that you have just the leading order term, and strong means that you have a subleading order term as well. Now, note that in our case, we also need the subleading term because for our function, it's h at 1 and 0. So the leading term in Widom's conjecture vanishes. Because the leading term has, in our case, order size to dimension t. And the subleading, we really need the subleading term to compute this this asymptotic formula for entanglement entropy. So I thought that's a nice connection. And in Onziger's computation, what he found is that above this so-called Curie temperature, the magnetization is zero. And then when you go below, then it grows with temperatures 1 minus this parameter to the power 1 over 8. And one over eight remarkably comes from this computation of the Toplitz symbolic formula of Toplitz term. So that that was all. Thank you very much.
Any questions?